For the week of September 19th, 2010, this is Showbiz Sandbox, Episode 72, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Bergen, Norway, I'm Jay Sperling-Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And outside the Lightbox in Toronto at the Toronto International Film Festival, I'm Michael Giltz.
You're still in Toronto?
Well, symbolically.
Okay. Well, I know we're going to be talking about Toronto a little later on during this episode, and we're going to have Ann Thompson from IndieWire here to join us. I know, Karen, at some point you've got to run off and help some customer. Apparently you have something called a job that pays you money.
I have a job, yeah.
We'll excuse you maybe during the Ann Thompson interview.
We call them clients, not customers, by the way.
Oh, well, sorry.
I call them cast members.
I call them bill pay people.
Well, apparently the hotel I'm staying in doesn't like to pay their bills, or they don't like to have big bills, because they say when you arrive at the Tone Hotel here in Bergen, Norway, that when you stay here, you get free internet access with speeds up to 1 megabit per second. And I was like, really? 1 megabit per second? Why not just dial up?
So it's up to 1 megabit. Good Lord. That's like the best you can hope for.
Right, exactly. And I did a speed test, and 1 megabit would be a nice thing to have right now.
Right.
So
how are you functioning?
Oh, don't ask. But I have to apologize in advance in case some of the audio quality for Karen and Michael degrades and kind of goes in and out. That's the reason.
So you're in Norway and you're tired and you have 1 megabit per second upload speed. I'm in New York, having just collapsed from Toronto. I'm exhausted. So it's going to be a scatterdash episode.
And unfortunately, I was going to ask both of you to carry me through this show because I'm exhausted. So now, Karen, can you carry both Michael and myself through this show?
Please.
I will do the best I can.
Well, Karen, we'll let you pay your bills or do whatever it is that you need to do to pay your bills when we give Ann a call. But in the meantime, we're going to, of course, talk about some movie news and the Toronto Film Festival with Ann Thompson, as I just mentioned. We're also going to talk about some music news during Inside Baseball. And because I'm still traveling and on the road, we're going to do a little bit of an abbreviated show. We're going to jump right into Big Deal or Big Whoop after our movie news. And, of course, we always start out with entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who fills us in on the weekend's box office.
The number one film of the weekend was a movie that premiered at the Toronto Film Festival, and it is The Town, starring Ben Affleck, starring and directed by Ben Affleck, I should say. It grossed $23.8 million, doing better than a lot of predictions, and was a rare adult film to top the charts. At number two was a high school comedy, Easy A, which grossed a strong $17.7 million. That was on a budget of $8 million, so they doubled their budget in the first weekend, which is always a good sign. At number three is Devil, the M. Night Shyamalan-produced film that opened to $12.2 million. A little soft, but not terrible, though the reviews were terrible. At number four is Resident Evil Afterlife. That grossed $10 million for a total of $43 million so far. And number five was an anonymous animated film called Alpha and Omega from Lionsgate. That grossed $9.1 million. Number six is Takers, which is chugging along. That's at $52 million total. Number seven, the George Clooney drama The American, which is at $32 million total. Not bad for a movie that cost $20 million to make. And number eight is The Other Guys, the Will Ferrell, Mark Wahlberg comedy, which is at $115 million total. And rare for a Will Ferrell movie, it's trying to make some money overseas, where it has grossed $9 million so far. And number nine is Inception, which is at $285 million in the U.S., and another $468 million overseas for $750 million total and counting. And at number 10, Lindsay Lohan's comeback film Machete, which has grossed $25 million total so far. I saw about a million movies over the weekend, but none of them were any of these. What about you guys?
I saw The Town.
Well, tell me.
It's really good. It's not a masterpiece, but it's well done. It's a lot of fun. I was never bored. And I think you guys would like it. But did you guys see on Ain't It Cool News, there was a piece, it was meant to be funny, a fictitious conversation between Ben Affleck and Jennifer Garner about the marketing of this movie, because the trailer always says, from the acclaimed director of Gone Baby Gone. And in this fake conversation, he's like, what the fuck? Why can't it just say from director Ben Affleck?
Well, there's an edit for you.
Sorry.
That's okay.
It's really funny. Nice, you've got to find
nice
it.
Nice language.
Yeah.
That's what he says in it. He's like, you know, what the F? Why can't it say from director Ben Affleck? Why does it have to say acclaimed director from Gone Baby Gone?
Well, I saw the film as well. I saw it in Toronto, and I read the book to prepare for it, as I like to do. And I was disappointed in it. I like Ben Affleck. I liked Gone Baby Gone. I thought that captured the book very well. It was based on a book by Dennis Lehane, the Oscar-winning writer of Mystic River. And this movie is based on a thriller by Chuck Hogan. And I just found it very anonymous. Everything they deviated from the book made it more obvious, more normal, more typical heist movie. And I don't know, after like a scene and a half, he and the bank manager are in love. I didn't go with it at all. But
oh, I didn't believe they were in love either.
Yeah.
Did you read Gone Baby Gone?
Yes.
Because I hated Gone Baby Gone because all the good parts of the book were gone.
Right. It was a great couple, but I thought it did a better job of trying to capture the complexity of the book than this movie did.
Probably.
But I mean, I like Casey Affleck a lot, so what can you say?
Oh, I can't stand him.
Well, I'm just surprised that you didn't include another little number in your weekend box office. Halo Reach came out, I think it was last Tuesday, and do you know how many units it sold or how much money it made in just 24 hours?
We're talking about the video game, right?
We're talking about a video game, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was 200 million.
Are you guessing or did you know that?
I think you told me about 15 minutes ago.
Oh, okay, during prep. Okay, well, yes.
You're spoiling the magic and mystery of the show.
Yes.
Sorry.
It's mysterious. Here's the thing. We read the news and then analyze it and deliver it back to you.
Well, and a few weeks ago, we had Madden NFL's latest edition. That probably grossed about $100 million in its first week. This movie, Halo, one of the biggest franchises of all time, that's grossing $200 million. Budgets for video games have been crawling up into movie level because they make so much money. For years now, they've been, you know, spending $10, $20, $30, $40 million to create these video games. It's a huge business. That's why you see spinoff movies like Resident Evil.
Right, although that was a video game in 1996, and it's now on its fourth film, and
right.
That's just remarkable that they're still making those movies, but they're making money, so what do I know?
And yet people who play video games still don't really get a lot of respect. We still kind of mock them.
What I'm sick of are movies that use video game tropes as sort of a jokey inside joke. Scott Pilgrim vs. the World did it very well. But I've seen like four or five other movies do it since, including a couple movies at Toronto where people are about to fight and then they cut to sort of a video game world where they're fighting in that manner. It's like, it was funny the first time, but enough already. But it's, the New York Times reviews video games now. They've been doing that for the last few years. They take it seriously. They review it as art. Roger Ebert had a huge blog internet discussion for months about whether video games were art. He scoffed at it and said, no, there's no video game created that has come even close to, say, you know, a great novel or a great movie. And people, you know, passionately arguing back and forth about what he should be looking at and look at the texture of this and the immersive experience of that. So video games are definitely coming into their own and are a huge business and, you know, are coming closer and closer to art, really. I would agree with that.
I think they are art. I think they're there.
You know, here are some of the numbers that I have on Halo Reach, which was released by Microsoft, is the, producer, publisher of that game. 31 million games have been played since its launch, and 98 million player games have been recorded. And this was as of today, so Tuesday, the week of the 19th. And I don't know what any of these mean. I mean, they have over 78 billion total credits have been earned. Do you know what any of this means?
Well, you might have to download some update or added features if you haven't bought it. You might buy it at a store and then have to download extra features. You earn credits by playing the game and going through levels, which give you options to do other things down the road. So the more you play, the more credits you get. So it's an example of how intensely people have jumped into the game and are, devoting 20, 30, 40 hours to exploring all the levels of it. I have a PS3 and I just use it for Blu-rays. I avoid video games. They scare me. I'd probably never stop if I started.
No, I suck at them. I have no problem stopping. I play them with a nerd boy friend of mine who, by the way, when he got the new Halo, he like spent all night playing with it. And we'll play it and I can't figure it out. I don't think I have the hand-eye coordination. I can't run and shoot at the same time. I can't do it.
Wait, I just want to clarify something. You have a nerd boyfriend and he spent all night playing with it. I just want to make sure I got that right. I'm just gonna.
Not quite what I said, but okay, we'll go with that.
I'm sorry. That's maybe how I perceived it.
I think it's how you perceived it.
I'm really tired. You guys are gonna have to carry me through this show.
Okay.
In fact, why don't we try and get Ann Thompson on the phone? Would this be a good time for you to run off and deal with your bill-paying client, customer, person, people?
Let me deal with my bill-paying clients.
Okay, well, what about the ones that don't pay their bills? Are you going to deal with them, too?
Oh, we know what happens to them.
and by the way, I made a mistake. Dennis Lehane did not win an Oscar for writing Mystic River. He didn't work on the screenplay. He just wrote the novel. So I didn't want you to walk away, Karen, with having that false information in your head.
Well, I think he deserves an Oscar because I think he's ridiculously talented. Not to mention, like, really good looking.
Yeah, he's a nice guy.
Well, I appreciate you saying that about me. It's very nice of you.
You really are tired, Sperling.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. You cut out for a second there, and then when you came back, I just heard you really good looking, and I assumed you must be talking about me. But...
All right, let's get Ann Thompson on the phone.
Okay. Now, we're letting Karen Woodward go because she's got, as we just mentioned moments ago, some clients she has to take care of. And I'm dialing up now Ann Thompson from IndieWire. And Ann, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, what have you been up to, Ann? Anything interesting over the past couple of weeks, say, since the beginning of September?
I went to Venice for the first time. I covered the festival, and one of the reasons I wanted to do that was because you do get a crack at some of the big movies early before everyone else, and it was true. I got to look at Somewhere from Sofia Coppola, and I got to look at Darren Aronofsky's Black Swan, and of course, I'm Still Here, the notorious Joaquin Phoenix movie, and so on, and I got a kick out of all that, and I got a kick out of being in Italy also.
Was it just gorgeous?
It was amazing. I've never been.
How would you compare the Cannes Film Festival, which we all attend, the Venice Film Festival, and the Toronto Film Festival? How do they compare to one another, or don't they? Or is it just a silly task to try and compare them?
Well, you could call Cannes a real world film festival, even if it's set in Europe. And it's a big market, a huge market, and it's an enormous gala every single night. I mean, I would put Venice as a much more small scale, much more Italian and European, and less of a global festival. And therefore, there weren't that many Americans there, a handful. And there were plenty of Brits, but it really did feel like being at a foreign festival in a way that even Cannes does not. And it was less of a market and less of a party every night kind of junket feeling. I mean, there were some interviews going on, but for the most part, people were really looking at the movies in a very pure kind of way. You really got that. There were people taking pictures on the red carpet, and there were people filing video, and that was going out to the world. But it was much more about the critics seeing the films and writing them up quickly for the internet in a very intense that way.
Now, when you say it's an Italian festival, something just conjures up pictures of people in black ties eating spaghetti while watching a movie. But I'm sure that's not what you mean.
It isn't the same kind of, you know, when you go to Toronto, it's such a big launch festival for the fall season, a big Oscar festival. You know, people are really gauging what's going to emerge in the Oscar race. And it's much more of a junket festival with lots and lots of interviews going on. But what was great about Venice was that my voice was a little bit more unique and inside Toronto, you just get buried in the din. You know, it's so noisy.
Is it because there's more journalists at Toronto?
Yeah, and that's true at Cannes too, even Telluride now. Telluride, I used to have the place to myself in a way, as far as blogging right away or with the trades and me blogging. Now Telluride has quite a sizable online contingent of people that are there for the very same reasons. They want to get their dibs in early on interviews and reaction to key fall movies.
Was Venice expensive to go to as far as staying there and all that?
Well, I was one of several journalists that were invited there. So I was, the hotel was paid for by Venice.
All right.
The IndieWire, my I was already budgeted to go to Telluride, so there was a budget for that, and that budget was applied to the airfare and everything and the expenses and so forth. But Venice will supply a hotel to the handful of American journalists that they want to bring in.
Now, Venice kind of overlapped Telluride, so you didn't go to Telluride because it happened at the same time, but it also overlapped Toronto, didn't it?
Actually, it did, and so it started before Telluride. Telluride, of course, took the Labor Day weekend, and it ended after Toronto began. But I left in time to get to Toronto on day one.
Okay.
So I missed the end of Venice. Therefore, I saw the town in Toronto, which was in Venice, and I saw Barney's Version in Toronto, which was in Venice, and I did not see The Tempest, which is going to be at the New York Film Festival.
Well, now, you know, ever since 1999, when American Beauty took home the top prize at the Toronto Film Festival, Toronto has been a huge launching ground for these Oscar-winning and Oscar hopefuls, and it seems to be working out. I mean, that's where The Hurt Locker premiered. It's where a number of Oscar winners have premiered, including Slumdog Millionaire. Although Slumdog Millionaire premiered at Telluride, you know, it used to be that if you had a film that had already been shown at another festival, then a worldwide festival like Toronto or Venice wouldn't take you. But now, within the space of a month, these festivals are all showing the same films.
Well, there's a different set of rules applied. I mean, Telluride is getting away with a great deal because they don't claim world premieres. They're basically going under the radar and just booking things without announcing them.
They're like a film club.
Yeah, that's their MO, and it works. In fact, they had an amazing lineup. They had Never Let Me Go, and they were also showing The Black Swan, but it was after Venice. I mean, Venice claimed the world premiere for the opening night of that, and it was the world premiere for all those films. But Telluride also showed them, you know, soon after. And then going to Toronto, you know, Toronto is a big smorgasbord. You know, they want the one, you know, the film that did not go to Toronto was Somewhere, and the other film was The Tempest.
So what role does Toronto play? I mean, this year we had the Audience Award winner was The King's Speech, and the Midnight Madness winner was Stakeland. Those were the big success stories, I guess, as far as the audiences were concerned, the public.
I would say The King's Speech came out of Toronto ahead of everyone in terms of the Oscar race. It is, in fact, an enormous Oscar movie. And Colin Firth is the one to beat. He didn't get it for Single Man last year. He delivers another extraordinary performance, amazingly strong.
And he plays the King of England, who has a stuttering problem, and Geoffrey Rush is his tutor to try and help him through help him with his speech impediment.
Yes, it's a slight problem if you're going to become a royal king. He is a royal, but to become the king, he has to be able. And it was very. He's a strong. The two of them going toe to toe is really fun to watch. And basically Geoffrey Rush is playing not only a speech therapist but a psychotherapist, and he's breaking down someone who ordinarily is behind all these walls of royalty and gentlemen. Lordship and all that stuff that, you know, he doesn't need to give up himself to anyone. And now he's being forced to do that. And the portrait that emerges is really heartbreaking. And Helena Bonham Carter is also very good.
It's a polished entertainment. And not only is it an Oscar hopeful, but I mean, I saw it with at the free screening at the end of the festival that they hold for the Audience Award winner. They show that movie again for free, and anyone can show up and line up and get a ticket. I had missed it, so that's where I caught it with a general audience, as general as you can ask for. And they just ate it up. I mean, the applause and the laughter. I mean, this is a potentially a really big hit for the type of movie that it is.
And Harvey Weinstein is very happy.
Yes, yeah. Because, of course, the Weinstein Company will be distributing that film. Now, I'd like to ask you, I have a list of all the films you saw in Toronto and their grades. Nothing below a C-.
Well, I don't know that we have every movie, but those were the ones that I caught that she listed on IndieWire. I might have missed some, so she might have had something below C-, but that's all I caught so far.
Okay, you like...
I almost... Almost gave I'm Still Here a D. I almost did.
Okay, well, let's talk about that film for a second. I'm Still Here is the movie that was made by Casey Affleck, the actor, and it is a quote-unquote documentary of Joaquin.
Well, no, it's a performance art piece with Joaquin Phoenix pretending to have a career meltdown. So did you when you saw the film, does it change your perspective on the movie, knowing now that they admit it was performance art, a sort of a Andy Kaufman-esque stunt rather than an actual depiction of an actor sort of spiraling down?
I was, of course, suspicious and skeptical, and unfortunately I was misled by Casey Affleck at the press conference there in Venice, saying, you know, that it really is a documentary and you should take it as face value and so forth. And I was really forced, therefore, to prevaricate a bit in the way that I wrote about and thought about the movie. You know, I wished he had been more forthcoming about what it really was, and so that we could judge it accurately.
Well, yeah, I mean, initially, it was considered a documentary, and he did, as you say, claim it to be a legitimate documentary about Joaquin Phoenix leaving the world of acting to try and become a hip-hop star. And he even goes to, you know, Sean P. Diddy Combs and tries to get him to be his, you know, his producer, and I guess at one point tries to hire prostitutes and is doing drugs, and you know, and it's,
yeah, which leads us all to be very suspicious that this could possibly be true. I mean, it's too outrageous that he would even destroy himself that way. But Casey Affleck was leading the media on, and I think in a very sort of condescending way, you know, in a hostile way, I would say.
Yeah.
I want to know what I'm seeing. I want to know what it is. You know, he's arguing now that he needed to keep us all, you know, fool us and so forth. And I'm not happy. It was very uncomfortable to write the review without knowing what it was. It really was. I found it very disconcerting.
And this falls into a category of films that are documentaries or pseudo-documentaries like Catfish and Exit at the Gift Shop. I mean, there's a lot of questions about documentary films now about how much is true and accurate. Is any of it staged? Is it all a stunt? People just aren't sure anymore. They're not sure what to
trust. And in this case, it's hard to say where those lines are drawn because, you know, some of it, there may be the ring of authenticity about some of what he was saying. One of the clues that the movie was in fact acted and performed was the fact that when he did go on Letterman, he was so much more out there than he was in the film. It was much more of a good performance, I thought. So that was one tip.
Well, and he went on Letterman in February of 2009, and that was the infamous performance where Letterman turned to him and said, gee, Joaquin, I'm sorry you couldn't be here tonight, because Joaquin Phoenix was just sitting in the guest chair saying nothing and just kind of mumbling to himself.
But he was really good in that scene. I mean, I really bought it. When I watched that on Letterman, I thought, my friends were saying, no, he's faking it. And I go, God, I don't know.
No, I mean, they pulled it off to a degree, but they didn't. And let me explain why. The movie is dying at the box office. I mean, nobody's going to see it. They're all reading about it. And I'm sure everyone will watch the Letterman show on Wednesday night when Phoenix emerges from the ashes and says, I'm still here, right?
Yeah, well, true.
With a clean shave. He was clean shaven. He was slim. He was there. He wasn't showing up anywhere in Venice or Toronto. But he's going to now try to get his career back.
Well, what about the deals at Toronto? Toronto's an Oscar launching pad, and there are also a fair number of deals. I think a lot of people felt that the market was not crazy so that people could make reasonable and good deals for movies, and therefore there was a lot more action than usual. We had Super, the Rainn Wilson comedy, and Meek's Cut Off, which is a Western that won the IndieWire Critics poll, and the Werner Herzog film Cave of Forgotten Dreams had a huge bidding war. So how did it feel like as a market at Toronto?
The market is definitely coming back. And I actually believe that what happened is that it became that much more difficult to make a film. The budgets came down. Stars got paid less. real labors of love were what got made. There was a lot less of that kind of, B-movie, wannabe commercial movies. A lot of these movies were genuine articles. And now, that said, the genre films sold the first, those are the films that really sold. Dirty Girl to the Weinstein Co. I really liked the movie that Magnolia picked up, Magnet picked up, called I Saw the Devil, which was from Kim Ji-woon, who's one of my favorite directors. He's South Korean, and he made The Good, the Bad, and the Weird.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of the most violent, disgusting serial killer movies you could ever see. But this guy is such a great stylist and such a smart director that I even though I'm like gagging, I was very impressed. Very, very and entertaining movie. Rabbit Hole did very well. Rabbit Hole was the movie that Lionsgate picked up, which will be an Oscar contender for Nicole Kidman, I think.
Well, now, Rabbit Hole is John Cameron Mitchell of Hedwig and the Angry Inch. He directed it. It's based on a Pulitzer Prize-winning play, which I saw, and the play was very, very good. But
and that guy wrote the adaptation as well.
Oh, okay. So, and the movie's good. I see that you liked it.
It's very strong. Going in, you wouldn't think, that John Cameron Mitchell was necessarily who you would expect to direct such a straight drama. There's no frills on it. There's no stylistic flourishes on it, really, except for one kid in the movie who's a comic book artist. So there's a little bit of that, but it hangs on the writing and very strong performances by Nicole Kidman and Aaron Eckhart and Diane Wiest. Really strong.
I have to ask you, did you just have like one of the best Torontos ever as far as the quality of films? I'm not sure how much you agonize over the letter rating.
I'll tell you what I did this year that was different. In the past, and you could argue with me about this, and the reason that I did it this way is that I came in from Venice with a bunch of interviews I had to do, basically. So in a way, I had to run around that first opening weekend that was so, so hectic, doing my little flip cam interviews, many of which I have not put up. Still, I have a backlog. And so I didn't organize myself the way I usually do, which is to go to all of the acquisition screenings at the first screening and see what all, track those and see what all the acquisitions buyers are doing. And what I did was I waited to hear the buzz on those. And mm-hmm. So I ended up picking wisely and going to a lot of good movies and not wasting my time on the bad stuff.
It looks like you've got 14 movies at least that you gave an A- or an A to. That sounds like a best of the year list ready to go right now. You have The King's Speech and Let Me In, The Vampire Remake, Buried, Inside Job, Client 9, 127 Hours, The Illusionist, Never Let Me Go, Tabloid, Another Year, which you saw first at Cannes, I imagine, I Saw the Devil, Rabbit Hole, Black Swan, and a movie I'm really sorry I missed, Detective D and the Mystery of the Phantom Flame. But I really wanted to see that. It's a martial arts movie, and it sounds just like a lot of
incredible
fun.
Incredible. Choi Hark, fabulous movie.
But boy, that sounds like a heck of a list.
That's a list that includes Cannes and includes Venice and includes Toronto. And I didn't go to that many bad movies in Toronto. That's what I'm saying.
Wow. Well, it sounds like it was a lot of fun.
And exhausting.
I was going to say tiring, but a lot of fun.
I also went to parties and I went to dinners and Sony had a great dinner. Weinstein's had a great dinner. I got to meet Tom Hooper, who is an impressive fellow, the guy who directed The King's Speech, which is also a very beautiful, beautifully directed movie, really beautifully done. Yeah.
Someday you'll have to tell us how you do it, because I've never known anyone like yourself who is able to be everywhere at a festival, doing the interviews, at the film, watching the films, at the press conferences, at the parties, and then you go home, you open the internet, and on IndieWire, Thompson on Hollywood is the ThompsonOnHollywood.com is the domain to look up, and you see that you filed somewhere in the middle of all of it. So I don't know how you do it, but you do it, and I'm just grateful.
Well, thank you, Sperling. I have help. I have people who help me. I mean, I'm not doing it by myself, and I also don't see as many movies as other people. I mean, other people see 5 movies a day. Someone like Meredith Brody, who was filing for IndieWire, for me, for Thompson on Hollywood. Meredith was seeing 4 or 5 movies a day. And so, and there is an illusion that I'm writing every single thing that's on there, and I'm not. If you check, if you look under the things, there's other people writing stuff. I might be editing or posting or helping or defining or assigning and all that, but I don't have to write everything. So I'm not a super person. I'm just tired.
You have house elves working for you.
I do. And they're very, Sophia Savage is very important. You know, she does the daily read every day, and she knows how to post things. You know, there's people back in the trenches helping me do all this.
And would you ever want to spend a year going to every single film festival possible? You could just work from January to December and just have the year of film festivals and go to Abu Dhabi, you know.
They invited me to go, and I turned them down because I'm just too tired. You know, I have to focus on the Oscar race now. It really is Oscar season.
Yep.
And I am competing with some pretty, you know, I have a site that covers lots of things. I don't just do the Oscars, but I still have to compete with the Oscar bloggers who do it full time. Right, that's all they do.
And in fact, we should say that you also have a podcast, Oscar Talk with Chris Tapley. And
correct, every Friday.
Yes,
tune in.
Fun.
And we should place links to that
which Jeff Wells has been arguing is too kind and too nice. So instead of listening to me and Chris go at it, you now have the choice of listening to Sasha Stone and Jeff Wells go at it. And I'll be curious to see if we lose any listeners.
That very well may be a first. Somebody is plugging a competing show. But
who would you rather listen to? That's what I'd like to know.
That's why I made no comment on the the other show that you may have mentioned. But certainly I appreciate you appearing on this show this week.
You are my most faithful retweeter. It's the least I can do.
Well, thank you very much. If anybody wants to follow Anne on Twitter, it's AK Stanwyck is the username to look up. Of course, we will place a link to that, to Oscar Talk, to Thompson on Hollywood, which can be found on IndieWire, as well as going to thompsononhollywood.com. We'll place all of those links in the show notes. Anne, thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that was fascinating to talk to Anne. I'm jealous that she got to go to Venice. Maybe they'll pay for me to fly out to Venice or at least give me a free hotel. That would be a lot of fun. But I've never been there. It's one of the European cities I really want to go to. But she's got that great ability to compare Cannes and Venice and Toronto. And it's an exciting life she leads.
Yeah, and she really is, I mean, known her or her work for well over 15 years, which is only a fraction of the amount of time she's been covering this industry. And it's, and that doesn't, you know, that's not said to like, oh, say,
she started
oh,
when she was four.
Yeah, she's been doing this for a very, very, very long time from a very, very, very young age. And she is absolutely fantastic. I always love talking to Anne, and I really can't thank her enough.
And I always skip parties and press conferences. So I don't know how, you know, I would never, you just can't do it all. So I don't know how she is at all those events, like you say.
Yeah. Well, before it gets too late, let me get Karen back on the line here, and we can move right into Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the week's top entertainment news stories and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. And hold on, Karen?
Social media are us.
Okay, well, I hope your client's paid and that your bills...
I want to take a moment to give a shout-out to anybody who likes entertainment and social media to try Miso at gomiso.com and Get Glue at getglued.com. Neither one of them are clients. I wish they were, but they allow you to – it's like Foursquare, but for entertainment stuff. So you can like check in when you're watching like Mad Men or something. Highly recommend it.
Oh, really? I mean, I have Miso every time I go and have sushi, but now I'll try this kind of Miso.
Yeah, it's better.
Okay, well – our first story this week is about a pop star, and really, all I remember is that he wanted his freedom. And, well, George Michael is headed to prison, and so maybe Lindsay Lohan, who just got out, can give him some pointers. That's one of the thoughts that may be swirling through the mind of pop star George Michael after a string of embarrassing incidents involving drinking and pot and driving, unfortunately all at the same time. Michael's has been sentenced to 8 weeks in jail for driving under the influence. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. That's some pretty serious accusations. Sounds like he needs a father figure.
Oh!
Good Lord. Yeah, I think it's a big deal too. He's still a big star throughout much of the world, and it's sad that he can't get his problems under control.
While Michael is in jail, he can always tweet to his fans and Lohan for support. Lindsay Lohan did just that recently when she revealed via Twitter that she had failed a court-ordered drug test. That constitutes a probation violation and may mean Lohan is headed back to jail, maybe in an adjoining cell to Michael. Although he's in the UK and she's in Los Angeles, so I highly doubt that. So, Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop? Not George Michael, but Michael who happens to be on this show.
I think it's a big deal and another example of how social media lets these stars cut out the middleman and just tell their story directly to fans.
Karen?
I agree, but also George Michael can tweet from jail?
But you're not supposed to be able to, but people have been doing it surreptitiously sometimes and getting
how?
Tweets out.
He has his phone?
Someone comes in there, they get access to a phone briefly. You know, they're not supposed to, but they do.
That's really sad.
Yeah.
Well, from Lindsay Lohan to Jennifer Lopez, J-Lo isn't in lockdown, but she is locking down the final details of her American Idol contract. Fox played hardball when Jennifer Lopez wanted a feature film greenlighted as a sweetener. But now everything is reportedly worked out, and the announcement will come just in time to goose attention for the first single from her new album being released in mid-September. Karen, is J-Lo joining Steven Tyler on Idol a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, first of all, I don't think Steven Tyler is officially made official. And second of all, I suppose we can all look forward to some god-awful romantic comedy coming out from Fox, right?
well, she didn't get that deal point.
Yeah, she didn't get the deal, so...
It says, everything is reportedly worked out. That doesn't necessarily mean that she didn't get the deal.
Oh, well, yeah. But people leaked the argument that she wanted a greenlit film and that they were saying no, so presumably that's not part of the deal.
Well, good for Fox, because I cannot stand watching her in another bad romantic comedy.
And she also wanted to get a television series produced, and they just said...
Well, she wanted to be a producer on, you know, TV pitches. She didn't necessarily want to star in it. She just wanted to, you know, have a production deal with Fox, both
right.
For TV shows and movies.
And a put picture deal is what she wanted, and she wanted $15 million, and reportedly she's getting 12. Big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop. This was news, like, maybe, what, 4 months ago?
4 months?
I no longer care.
American Idol, you are dead to me. Michael.
Well, none of it's official, so I think it's a big deal. It's the number one show in the country. They're radically revamping it. They're rolling the dice with a whole new approach to the show, so we'll have to see how it works out.
Well, you guys can see how it works out. I'll be the guy who doesn't watch the show at all.
I'm totally watching. Unless the contestants are as awful as they were last season.
Well, speaking of contestants, did anybody see Bristol Palin dance on You Can Dance with People Who Might or Might Not Be Stars?
No.
Okay.
Dancing with the C-listers? No, I missed it.
Okay, well, moving on. J-Lo may be getting a multi-year $12 million contract for being a judge on Idol. We'll find out tomorrow, actually, on Wednesday, when we will be posting this podcast, because apparently they're announcing, Fox is going to be announcing the judges tomorrow. But that's the sort of paycheck that even the stars of Big Bang Theory can respect. They all renegotiated their deal as the show's leads to Thursday's 8 p.m. time slot on CBS. Johnny Galecki, Kelly Cuoco, and Jim Parsons will get $200,000 per episode, or about $4 million a year, with bumps up in years to come. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal, and it's interesting to hear that maybe Jim Parsons tried to do a deal on the side. They didn't do the whole friends approach of negotiating all as a group, which they should have, and some people say they might have gotten more money, and I agree, but it's a lot of money, $4 million a year, so, you know, good for them. It's their biggest hit, and they're going to anchor Thursday, so this was the time to cash in.
And cash in they did.
I agree. It's a big deal for the same reason. Except, God, how awful that Jim Parsons decided to go off on his own to negotiate, if that's actually what happened. I like it when they do the friends approach. It says, hey, we work for an ensemble, as opposed to saying, hey, I'm the star of the show, I've got a bloody Emmy, pay up.
A bloody
Emmy?
Emmy!
Well, it's not only nice, it makes you look good, it's just very smart negotiating tactic.
Well, and,
you know, so it's good on every level.
And you can't blame Jim Parsons. It could have been his representation that insisted that he negotiate alone.
No, I do blame him. He's in charge.
Doesn't have the ability to say no? He hires
in charge. Yeah. He is in charge. He is responsible for what his agent and managers do. They're not, you know, they don't tell him what to do.
Yeah, they work for him.
Yeah.
He hires them to give
him if he hires jerks, that's his fault.
I agree.
Well, the media was trying to pry out the details of that Big Bang negotiation, but some steps crossed the line. Like, for example, tapping your phone. That's what Rupert Murdoch's News of the World reportedly did in trying to dig up dirt on celebrities like UK comedian Steve Coogan. Thousands of people were hacked into, and some of them are looking to sue, including Coogan. Guess he won't be guest starring on any Fox shows anytime soon. Karen, is this hacking into celebs' phone a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, obviously, but I think an even bigger deal, or maybe just a cooler deal, is that now Steve Coogan is threatening to sue Rupert Murdoch.
Michael?
It's a huge deal. I mean, it's just... It's shocking, and I hope that if they sue, that they sue successfully and make them pay tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. So often these fines end up being not commensurate to the crime that they did, and this is just shocking.
I think that News Corp has already paid about $1.6 million in this case.
That's nothing.
It's a big deal in the UK, that's for sure.
Yeah.
It's all over the headlines. But and I should mention here, I can hear you guys are kind of breaking up. And again, it's because I'm traveling, so I apologize and appreciate our listeners bearing with us. Moving on to News of the World, which is probably looking for some personal dirt, but I'm sure they covered this news. Sacha Baron Cohen, a.k.a. Borat, has signed on to play Freddie Mercury of Queen. The script is being written by Peter Morgan, who wrote Frost Nixon, and will go into production next year. The film will chart Queen's rise from the early days to their triumph at Live Aid. Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a huge deal. It could totally, you know, change our perception of Sacha Baron Cohen. I would have probably gone with a nobody to play Freddie Mercury. It's such a hard role. You've got to not be only be a great actor, but have the charisma of a rock star. You know, it's just, it's a huge challenge, and who knows if he'll pull it off, but it's fascinating to think about.
I'm kind of two minds of this. On one hand, I totally agree with you, Michael, that this is a big step in Sacha Baron Cohen's career. But on the other hand, I think this is sort of a big whoop because you know how I feel. Man gets job.
Right. Yeah, I knew when I put this in, I thought, I know what Karen's response to this is.
No, but when I first read this, I was like, wow, that's actually really interesting.
But I think that people have been trying to make a movie about Freddie Mercury and Queen for quite some time, and so now it looks like it's actually moving forward with Queen's participation, or at least the estate of Freddie Mercury. The real question is, can Sacha Baron Cohen sing, and can he sing as good as Freddie Mercury?
Well, and can he act? I mean...
Oh, he can't act. He can't act at all. I mean, he's never acted before. No, he can't act. He does not completely inhabit a character. That's the problem.
Well that's what he has to do.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe it's not coming through because you know I'm a million miles away in a different country on a different continent. But that was what is generally known as sarcasm.
Oh.
Well, no, I don't think he can act necessarily. He's a sketch comedy guy.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, the challenge of what he did in Borat is a specific and difficult challenge. I'm not downplaying it, but it's not the same as playing a role of a character with an emotional arc. I mean, that's a very different thing. You know, he's been in other movies and I haven't been impressed by him in Sweeney Todd or anything else that he's done.
Well, I've never seen any of the artwork or paintings that Sacha Baron Cohen has done.
What? God almighty, you're tired.
I said I was tired. We should move on.
I don't think he'll be singing though, by the way. He's not going to be doing his own singing.
Let's hope not. Unless he can sing, in which case, it would be interesting to see. But moving on. They just don't make best dress lists like they used to. People magazine's Style Watch has released their 10 best dress list for 2010, even though the year has 3 months to go. On the list, Jennifer Aniston, Rihanna, and Jessica Alba. But Lea Michele? Zoe Saldana? Of Avatar and Star Trek? Wait a second. I'm not on this list? Well, then it's obviously bogus. Karen, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I'm a girl, so I always like this. I think ultimately it's a big whoop, although I suppose a designer would disagree with me.
Probably. Michael, what do you think?
I think it's a big whoop. It's just a blog entry. It's not even like, you know, the who's the guy who does the annual best dress list? Or he did for many
Blackwell?
Years. Yeah, he's the gold standard. And as the LA Times post mentioned in their blog post about this list, where's Carrie Mulligan? You know, she's on the cover of Vogue. She's been in red carpets all over the world. She's got that pixie-ish, you know, Mia Farrow-type charm. She should have definitely been on the list.
What, because she's got pixie-ish Mia Farrow-like charm? That's nothing to do with
Right? She's on the cover of Vogue, and she's been sporting designer dresses and red carpets all over the world.
Frankly, I hate everything she wears.
Oh.
What about her underwear? Do you hate that too?
Is this a segue of some kind?
No, not at all. No segues. I'm too tired for segues.
All right.
Okay, well, that kind of wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop, and moves us right into Inside Baseball, our weekly segment where we discuss the news stories that only people in Hollywood might care about. And this week, we have some music news, and I'm going to let Karen take this news because I have no idea what it's about.
So Tom Whaley's leaving Warner Brothers Records. I put this in the show notes as an example of how music's changing, and that's why I think it goes so well with Google's proposal for a new music service, which is that they want to do... It's twofold. They want to have sort of an iTunes where you can buy specific songs just like you do on iTunes, but also streaming. So it's like subscriber-based.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the way most of these services are going, whether it's Rhapsody or whether it's Spotify in the EU. It's
now,
all...
Why is Spotify not here?
Because
they can't make the deals.
They can't make the
licensing deals.
That's absolutely correct. And they've been trying, and they keep saying, no, we're going to be there this fall. And, except they've been saying that for a year. So it's been gone from fall to winter, winter to spring to summer. Now it's in fall. And, you know, sometime this fall, they'll say it'll be here this winter, you know, early next year.
So Tom Whaley has been a top person at Warner Brothers for a long, long time. He talks about the tradition of Warner Brothers Records, how they built themselves up with artists that didn't seem like big commercial prospects like Randy Newman and Neil Young and Buffalo Springfield, and how having those acts brought in other acts and created a culture. So they ended up with, you know, Jackson Brown and Eagles and huge best-selling acts. And, you know, it sounds like he's describing, you know, ancient Rome. It's so far in the past. And the idea of a record label cultivating a stable of artists who all want to be in the same label because it's good, it sounds quaint and foreign, you know. Now you talk about your digital streaming and your ringtone sales. It's the end of an era. Google's proposal for a music service, just like Spotify, they've been going to all the major record labels and trying to make a 3-year deal to launch this service. The one thing I think that's a little different from the other services is that they want to go into your computer and take all the music you have and make it available on your locker. Other people want to do that, but they want to limit it to stuff that you've bought from them or stuff that they can officially verify. Google's like, look, we just got it. If you've got it on your computer, we're going to put it up there. And that scares the major label. Google's saying, we don't care whether you got it from peer-to-peer. We don't care whether you ripped it off a CD. We don't care if you bought it from another service. If you have music on your hard drive that we don't know is, you know, wildly illegal, we're going to put it available in your locker. In my case, that would be about 6,000 CDs of music, mm-hmm. and that would be really useful to me. The major labels are scared about this, and they don't know what to do. They're going to ask Google to do things like not allow searches on Google for illegal websites and illegal pirate things. They're trying to get them to agree to do things to fight piracy if they agree to do this. It's the only way to do it. If you want to make a real locker, you've just got to accept that if someone has it on their computer, their music should be part of that locker. And that means you could be in your car and put in your iPhone and have access to 6,000 CDs, or you could be on your laptop in Norway and have access to all your music without having to carry an extra hard drive around with you, which is what I'd have to do right now.
Well, what if you only have 1 megabyte of throughput?
Well, you know, seriously, that's my argument against this whole need for the locker. Most people can fit every single darn song that they own onto their iPhone or onto their, you know, iPod or whatever their musical device is, or their laptop. So they don't have a huge need. Most people don't have thousands of CDs. You know, they can fit everything they own on a phone. To me, it doesn't seem that necessary, but that's a different issue.
Well, a couple things. One, what you're talking about, Michael, is what Lala did, the digital lockering, where they kind of read your iTunes library and they found all of your files and they said, okay, so you have 2,000 songs, you can now listen to them through Lala. Apple bought Lala, and there's talk that Apple is going to do the very same thing that we're not saying.
Apple is only going to allow it if you bought the music from Apple.
No, they're talking about doing the exact same thing.
I question that. Everything I've read says they absolutely will not allow you to. They will not recognize music unless it was bought through Apple.
Maybe I'm getting Google mixed up with Apple. But now let me ask you something. You were talking about Warner Brothers and how they signed some non-traditional artists like Neil Young and the Eagles, and those went on to become...
The Eagles were a big act from the get-go, but like Neil Young and Randy Newman, artists that they cultivated for a long time who weren't necessarily big sellers, but gave them an aura that meant other people wanted to be involved with Warner Brothers, and that helped them get momentum and get huge acts and become a massive, you know, record label.
Did Tom Whaley have anything to do with that, and is that why it's important that he's leaving?
Well, in his goodbye memo to the staff, he talked about that tradition at Warner Brothers. He's been there for a long time, but in doing that, he began there in 1979 in the mailroom. So he's been with Warner Brothers for a long time. The artists I described started before he arrived, but he's been there with that tradition and that philosophy of building up huge acts like Bjork. You know, Bjork is not a big-selling artist. Flaming Lips, you know, and those people helped lead you to people like, you know, Enya and Eric Clapton and Faith Hill and the Goo Goo Dolls and Green Day and Katie Lang, you know, R.E.M. You know, there's a mixture of artists that, you know, they're proud of. And his extolling of that, you know, that vibe and that belief and that philosophy just seemed quaint to me in this day and age when nobody talks about artist development or anything like that.
I wonder if he knew that on some level, because I was at a panel last night, too, where somebody said, when are they going to get it? When is everyone going to understand, you know, that social media and, you know, like transmedia storytelling and all that, this is the future. When are people going to understand it? And someone on the panel, their response was, when the dinosaurs leave. Tom Whaley is a dinosaur. A lot of the people at the top right now are dinosaurs. And it's the people that are, you know, even two levels below them that get it.
Well, he wrote this memo, Tom Whaley of Warner Brothers Records, who I guess is, as we're reporting, leaving, and in it he mentions, I think, every artist that has ever recorded on the Warner Brothers label.
He talked, not even close, of course.
But, yeah, but I mean, he lists like 50 people, 50 yeah. bands, Randy Travis, Red Hot Chili Peppers, R.E.M., Seal, Tom, and notice how they're all in alphabetical order, too. I thought that was very, very interesting.
Very
and then
smart.
He goes on, to, and his, then in the next paragraph he says, and established many great new artists, including, and he goes on and lists like 30 different acts.
Are they in alphabetical order, too?
Yeah, of course.
Like Taking Back Sunday and Tegan and Sarah and the Raconteurs, which is the White Stripes spinoff, and Regina Spektor and the Black Keys. And these are artists that have, you know, created some of the best albums of the last, you know, 5-10 years. But I don't know if he's a dinosaur in the sense that he doesn't appreciate social media. I don't think there's a conflict between, you know, cultivating a roster of great artists and using all the tools available to you to promote them.
That's not really what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that the entertainment world is changing in a major way, and it's going to take a whole new way of thinking. And a lot of the people who are at the top right now just don't have that energy. I mean, it's really starting from scratch in a lot of different areas, and I just don't think they want to do it. I don't think they're stupid. I think in a lot of cases they understand what they don't know. They simply can't go through it again.
That makes sense. It's really a world for indies and small startups rather than big, giant record labels.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's like the people are taking over again. You have to completely adjust your way of thinking.
Well, on to listener email. You just said you don't think they're stupid. Now, let me ask you this. Do you think this is stupid? Aaron Rich, our good friend from, I believe, Brooklyn, he wrote in and he cited a Huffington Post article here, and of course Huffington Post is Michael's stomping grounds. It's about Bill Maher, who says, I'll never win an Emmy because I'm an atheist. And Aaron Rich writes, I think Maher is totally nuts for thinking this, and it just sounds like sour grapes. As an avid Maher viewer and an atheist myself, I consider his honey hole to be libertarianism, pro-pot legalization, atheism, anti-marriage, pro more sex for himself with hot women. And these are all in quotes, by the way. I have no reason to believe that Emmy voters care if he has a relationship with God or not. Couldn't they just be prudes who hate pot or strong believers in marriage? Also, couldn't he submit clips of his show that were specifically not anti-religious, just political stuff? Is it possible that he's losing to funnier people? Or that any award show is dumb and one loses for random reasons? Like Susan Lucci, or Hitchcock, or Scorsese, until recently. His saying that, quote, half of the panel who watched the tapes are religious is arbitrary and unsupportable. Maybe he should write better stuff, or change the format of the show, or not give a crap about a dumb Emmy rather than crying foul. I would expect more from him than this.
Yeah, I mean, I find that interesting. I saw the Bomar comment as well. I've always thought Hollywood was godless, so I wouldn't think that would hurt you at the Emmy Awards. But, you know, he's been nominated like for 20 years in all his different shows, whether it's Politically Incorrect or Real Time with Bill Maher and other venues, and he's never won. And he's always made sort of jokes about it and stuff. I think it is mostly just random. At certain periods when he had his mojo going, somebody else had it as well. So it was Letterman or Jon Stewart rather than him. I think Aaron's right. They'd be better off to just, you know, shut up and not care that much about an award show. But it's a little annoying. He's got like a record. I think he has approaching a record number of nominations without a win. If not, he already has that, you know, that record.
He's been nominated 22 times, 11 for Politically Incorrect with Bill Maher.
Right. At this point,
I think that beat Susan Lucci.
Right. Oh, absolutely. And this year, I think I would celebrate that rather than worry about why it's not. And they did it. It's because he's an atheist. That probably bothers a minority of the voters, but probably none of the ones that would have voted for him in the first place.
I agree. That strikes me as a really, really random comment.
Yeah, but it wasn't just an off-spoken thing. He wrote about it on Huffington and you know, spoke about it at length, so it wasn't some off-the-cuff remark, I don't believe. So I think Aaron got it about right.
Yes, Aaron, thank you for your email. If you would like to email us, you can. The email address to send your missives off to is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can find that address as well as our phone number where you can leave us a voicemail on our website, showbizsandbox.com. And if you want to call us, you can do so. 888-567-SAND is the number to call. Again, that's 888-567-7263. Our website, Showbiz Sandbox, is also where you'll find links to all of the stories we discussed in today's episode, including all of Ann Thompson's stories on Toronto. And it's also where you'll find links to all of our social networking accounts that Karen could tell you more about if we would give her the time to do so. But she's got paying clients and we have to go.
Let me just get you started here.
Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. So showbizsandbox.com, definitely check it out. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each of our shows is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. They're also on MySpace, myspace.com/MGMT. Michael Giltz is on his website, michaelgiltz.com, and he's on Twitter, @MichaelGiltz is the username to look up. Karen Woodward is on Twitter, not only for herself, @Karen_Woodward, but also for all of her paying clients, apparently, as well. Karen, you also have a website, karenwoodwardonline.com. I have a website, celluloidjunkie.com, where you can find some of my writing. I'm on Twitter, @Sperling is the username to look up. And next week, I will be in France. So hopefully we'll have a better internet connection. Thank you for putting up with us.
And we'll do better.
We'll do better. We promise. I'll be less tired, hopefully. Until next week, play nice.